America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a call-in show today. Our topic, once again, is healthcare, so please call with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Let me repeat that for you. That's 1-800-313-9443. Folks, today we have a very exciting show. First, we have our special commentator, Ms. Megan O'Toole, with us today. Hello, Megan.
Hello, Michael.
Good. I'm glad you're here. And I'm very, very honored to welcome our special guest today, Dr. Walter Block. Hello, Walter.
Hello. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you. So, folks, we're very, very fortunate to have Dr. Block with us today. Walter is an eminent economist who is a professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, Louisiana. He is an adjunct scholar at the Mises Institute and at the Hoover Institute. Walter has written over 300 scholarly articles, several books, and was an economic advisor to presidential candidate Ron Paul. Walter, we're very happy to have you with us today. A few weeks ago, we had Dr. Yuri Maltsev, an economist who defected from the Soviet Union, on our show, and he talked about what Soviet healthcare teaches us. What have we learned or not learned about socialized medicine since the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, I don't think we've learned much of anything, if you use the word we to not include libertarians such as you and I and other libertarians. We've learned a lot, or we didn't because we knew it before that. But what they haven't learned, Obama, the Republicans, the Democrats, is that socialism doesn't work. Socialism is immoral. Socialism is not efficacious. Socialism leads to starvation. Socialism is a bad trip. They haven't learned that, and now they're trying to apply it to, what is it, one-sixth of the entire economy, the health field?
Right.
And this is a recipe for disaster.
Why does socialism always fail?
Well, there are various theories. One theory, perhaps the simplest theory, is that you don't have much incentives. If part of socialism is equal pay for everybody, whether you work hard or smart or dumb and not working hard, you get paid the same, well, then the incentives are not there. Ayn Rand had a very good thing in her Atlas Shrugged about that automobile company that followed that policy, and the best people left. So that's perhaps the simplest reason. Another reason is that in socialism or public ownership, if you do a good job, you don't get more money, and if you do a bad job, you don't get less money. Often you get less money, you get more money if you do a bad job. For example, I live in New Orleans, and Katrina came, and the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA, between them, killed 1,500 people because of their lousy protection against the flooding, and FEMA stopped people from helping us, and yet they're still in business, and they get more money. So that's the second reason.
Mm-hmm.
The third is the Hayekian reason. It comes from F.A. Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, a Nobel Prize winner, and what he says is that the information, without the prices that a free market generates, the information simply isn't there. Imagine everyone sending Obama, the czar of the economy, messages as to what we think he should do. Should he open this restaurant? Should he put this on the menu? Should he hire this guy, fire that cook, whatever? He would be inundated with messages, and the information would be unable to get through. What Hayek says is that prices convey this information in a very, very sophisticated but simple way. For example, he used the example of tin. If we discover that there's more tin, a new tin mine comes, the price of tin comes down, and people are able to use more tin than they thought they would be able to use. And obviously, if tin discoveries don't uphold, then the opposite.
Okay.
Is that music telling me to stop?
Yes, it is, actually. Okay. We have another few seconds before this break, and so I'm going to break in here and tell everybody to please stay online. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Please stay with us. We have Dr. Walter Block. We're talking about health economics. This is Michael McKay, Radio Free Markets. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and we have the distinct pleasure of having Dr. Walter Block with us today talking about health economics. Walter was just talking, answering my question of why does socialism always fail. I believe you had a couple of additional comments, Walter.
Yes, the first three were lack of weeding out process of failure and lack of incentives and the Hayekian thing about information. And I think the most sophisticated one is comes from Ludwig von Mises, who said that unless you have prices that are free market prices that represent scarcity of people and costs, you're in a calculational chaos. You don't know whether to build rowboats out of tin or lumber or plastic or whatever. You don't know whether to train five more nurses or one MRI machine or a half a doctor or whatever, because without prices you have this calculational chaos. The only reason the Soviet Union lasted as long as it did is because they had a black market, which was sort of marketed, and also they had access to U.S. or Western prices. But had they not, they never could have lasted without starvation. So those are the main four reasons why socialism can't work.
Okay, great. Bacon, you had a question.
Yeah, I've often encountered here at the State University where I teach in Pittsburgh, Kansas, the idea that we are not Soviet Russia, and we're not these other countries, and we're Americans, so that means we can do it better. We can do socialism correctly. And I'm curious to know what Dr. Block has to say about that.
Well, I think that that's silly. The Russians are pretty smart people. They were able to do a Sputnik. If you look at the chess grandmasters out of the top 500, they must have 300 in there. I'm not sure of that number, but they're bright people. And when we have socialism in this country, it doesn't work any better than it works anywhere else, because this has got nothing to do with people. It's got to do with economic theory. For example, we have socialism in the post office. Now, how great is the post office mail service? We have socialism in the motor vehicle bureau. You go in the motor vehicle bureau in most places, and you wait on this gigantic line. We have public roads, which are socialist roads, and a lot of times what you'll have is traffic congestion, bumper-to-bumper traffic, waiting on long lines. You know, there was this movie, Moscow on the Hudson, where it showed that in the Soviet Union, you just get online because you never know what it's for, but you get something, and they have these gigantic long queues of, you know, trying to get pickles or toilet paper or whatever. Well, those bumper-to-bumper traffic is also socialism. So when we have socialism in the United States, it works just like socialism anywhere else, because it's got nothing to do with the people. Mm-hmm. It's got to do with economics.
But we have Obama, and he's offering us hope.
True. Maybe Obama can change the laws of economics. Look, he won the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, after, I think he was nominated for that after about 10 days in office. So it's possible that Obama can change the rules of economics, and we have to be open to this possibility because he is a miracle worker.
Maybe even the laws of gravity.
That's right. He can repeal gravity. He can repeal economics, physics. Nothing is beyond him. So we always have to take this with a grain of salt. But barring miracles of the sort that Obama promises, economics is economics, and it applies in the U.S., it applies in France, it applies in Mars, if there were people in Mars. It just applies everywhere that the geometry applies, economics applies.
You know, I heard you speak in August, Walter, and you outlined more important things than healthcare, food, shelter, clothing, for example. Why don't we have socialism being suggested in these more important areas?
Well, that's true, although we do have a little bit of socialism in food with agricultural price supports and things like that, but you're quite right. Most people, if we don't have food for a day or two or three, will die. If we don't have medical care for two or three days, you know, there are some examples on record where doctors go on strike, and guess what? The death rate falls.
The death rate falls when doctors go on strike?
Yes. Now, I'm not saying that this means that the doctor's productivity is negative. I think that doctor's productivity was negative in the 19th century, but in the 20th century it became positive. What happens is when there are no doctors on call, there are no dangerous operations. And when you have a dangerous operation, you can die from it. So you have no operations at all, dangerous or not, so the death rate slightly falls. But that's just an anomaly. The point is that if we didn't have medical care for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, very, very few people would die. But if we didn't have food for a couple of weeks, we'd all die.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's any case for socialist anything, we should do it in food, not in medicine. So it is a bit of a puzzle as to why miracle worker Obama wants to, or miracle worker Hillary Clinton before him wanted to socialize health care. Who knows? I guess this is you got to be trendier than thou, and you and I are not as trendy as we should be, so we don't know the answer to this.
What about the objection that we should not take advantage of other people's needs?
Ah, yes. By the way, I did find that thing about the lady and the horse that you're asking.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, yeah.
So when and if you want that.
Yeah.
Yes, we should take advantage of other people's needs. That's what the laissez-faire capitalist system does. It takes advantage of people's needs by providing them with what they need. Look, when I go to McDonald's, they take advantage of my need for a burger.
Yeah.
Isn't that vicious of them? And how do they take advantage? How do they exploit me? Well, by giving me a burger for $1.50 or whatever. Well, you know, that's the kind of exploitation we want. You know, so it's just silly to say they take advantage of needs. I mean, all trade and purchases are part of trade are mutually advantageous. I value the burger more than the $1.50 it costs me. They value the $1.50 more than the burger.
Mm-hmm.
We trade and we each gain. So if they're taking advantage of my need for burgers, I'm taking advantage of their need for a $1.50.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just economic illiteracy to look at it that way.
You know, there's this thing that we hear called moral hazard when people view that someone else is paying and that occurs and people take advantage of a zero-price situation. You know, how does this apply?
Yes, well, moral hazard is the idea that if they take away your incentive to behave yourself, well, then you won't behave yourself. If my house is insured for twice the value of the house and a fire comes up, well, do I have much of an incentive to stop the fire? No, I'm going to cheer on the fire and maybe even set it myself. So, or let's say something is free. Ice cream is free. Well, I'm going to have a lot more ice cream at a free price than I would have at the ordinary price, and we're going to have a lot more ice cream consumed, a misallocated amount compared to the amount that we would consume if prices were reflecting costs.
Well, when people can get something for free and they're naturally incentivized to take advantage of that, how could government possibly control that?
Well, what they do is they have queues. In Canada, I don't know if it's free, but it's relatively cheap, you know, like $10 or something like that, which is very close to free for medical services. And they have long, long lines. And I guess this is where that lady with the horse comes in.
Yes, you had mentioned this. You have a letter, I think, you read. I'd love if you have it available, you could read it to us.
Yes, I'll read it to you right now.
Yeah.
This is here's the quote. My sister and her husband own and operate a cattle ranch in southwest Saskatchewan. That's in Canada. On this ranch, they have several saddle horses. About 3 years ago, one of the horses became ill and was in obvious distress. She took it to the nearest vet clinic where it was diagnosed with gallstones, apparently a very painful condition for horses as well as people. The vet recommended that the horse be operated on as soon as possible. My sister left the animal with the vet who operated on him that very night. My sister picked up the horse 4 days later and took it home, and after a couple of weeks of rest, the horse was as good as new. At about the same time, my sister's friend in the city of Saskatoon, which is in Saskatchewan, Canada, was also diagnosed with gallstones, and the doctor recommended that she be operated on as soon as possible also. There's one glitch in this, as soon as possible, and Saskatchewan's healthcare system means 18 months. So this 35-year-old mother of one had to put her life on hold, endure several trips to the emergency room whenever she had an attack. She could not afford the ambulance, not covered by Medicare, so she had to take a cab every time she had one. Then she sat in emergency for several hours until they gave her a bunch of powerful painkillers and sent her home. All of this severely curtailed her enjoyment of life, as you can well imagine. After 18 months of this, she was operated on. My sister pointed out that if she had made a horse wait 18 months, she would have been found herself in front of a judge answering charges of cruelty to animals, and rightfully so. No one would do that to an animal, but apparently it is acceptable to do it to humans in Canada, unquote. Well, you know, what we should do if we're going to have socialized medicine, let's have it for horses. The hell with horses. Humans before horses.
Right.
But obviously, I'm not a person who believes in cruelty to animals, so PETA, get off my case. I don't think we should have socialized medicine for animals or humans, and because it's cruel to make long, long lines, and yet at a zero price or at a very, very low price, demand is always going to be greater than supply, and there's no way to bridge the gap unless the price rises.
And so we have a free market for animals, free market for healthcare for animals, which works, and a free market and a less free market for human beings, which doesn't work as well.
Right, very perverted. I mean, I'm for animal rights, but I'm for human rights even more than that.
Well, what would a free market in healthcare look like?
Well, a free market for healthcare I think the key element is that it would be much cheaper. Right now, it's very, very expensive. People have no incentives to comparison shop because it's all paid for by government-supported insurance. And also, doctors make a ton of money. Doctors make $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, and that's sometimes after expenses, sometimes before you pay off your nurse and your secretary. Doctors make four or five times as much as PhD biologists, who I think if medical schools opened up their roles to more medical school entrants, would be able to become doctors. But the AMA is a very powerful union, and it precludes entry, it restricts entry in order to keep prices up.
Yeah, we're going to
come
back to this particular point.
I'll continue this.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much for that point. We're going to come back to this particular point after the break, folks. You're going to want to hear this. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking with Dr. Walter Block, and this is Michael McKay. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. Welcome, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me is our special commentator, Megan O'Toole, and our very special guest, Dr. Walter Block. And by the way, folks, this is a call-in show. Please be sure to call us if you have any questions or comments or would like to discuss this health economics issue at 1-800-313-9443. So, Megan, you made a comment during the break. I'd like to give the floor to you.
Yeah, just as my perspective as a younger person is that this bill that's just been passed through the Senate, it's going to influence my future earnings as a young adult because these are going to impose and raise taxes on working people, and it's going to force us, it'll be a mandatory thing that we will have to pay for health insurance for other people and pay for medical costs and absorb the medical costs for people who are not working. And we will also be forced to have health insurance when we don't necessarily want it. I mean, they talk in the news articles like it's this big tragedy that millions of people go uninsured. Well, have they ever considered the thought that perhaps these people don't want the health insurance and that's why they don't have it? You know, and not everybody needs it in order to survive or to be well. They might want to pay out of pocket for it because the health insurance companies don't give them a good deal. And I'm someone in that category because I'm healthy and I take care of myself and I don't need health insurance at this time.
Right. Well, I certainly agree with you that this puts burdens on innocent people. That this is we talked about the inefficiency of socialism, but socialism is also immoral. We're in effect fining you or punishing you, and you're an innocent person. You have not committed any crime. And by what right does the government come after you and make you pay more money for other people? This is just theft from some people to others. It's not really insurance. Insurance is a pooling of risk, but it's always on a voluntary basis.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the government will now say, well, since we're making you get insurance, we're going to make sure you're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of paternalism in Canada, like if you ride a bicycle, they make you wear a helmet. And if they keep extrapolating in this direction, they're going to make you go to bed with a helmet because if you fall out of bed, you can get hurt. So it's just silly. And, there's all sorts of stuff about hang gliding and fatty foods. And you can't eat chocolate because that'll make you unhealthy. And God forbid you should ever come near a cigarette. That's disgusting. So we're instead of going away from prohibition of things like heroin and marijuana, we're going toward prohibition of fatty foods and French fries and chocolate, and maybe they'll start prohibiting alcohol, and we'll get back to the prohibition of alcohol at the rate they're going.
That would be a problem in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well,
and in the United States, but, that would be a problem.
Yes, indeed.
Well, you know, we don't have problems in any of the free market industry aspects in healthcare, LASIK surgery, plastic surgery. Those technologies seem to continue to improve. Those prices continue to go down. No insurance is covered, no government mandates or restrictions other than, you know, against fraud or force. So right there on its face, we see evidence that this can work in a free market environment.
Yes, well, what we really should do, if we're going to have socialized medicine, we should have socialized medicine for these unimportant things, like plastic surgery, which are less important than, heart operations on your heart or your kidney or your lungs or something like that. Namely, socialized medicine kills. Free market medicine saves lives. And again, we're being very perverse, not only with horses and humans, but now within the human race, we're undermining important health, like for lungs, kidneys, whatever, knees, eyes. And instead, we're freeing up things that are a little bit more superficial, such as plastic surgery. Now, I'm not trying to diminish plastic surgery. It's important, too, but relative to hearts, kidneys, livers, lungs, it's a lot less important.
I've heard you say before that if we're going to have socialism, it should be for unimportant things like rubber bands and paper clips.
Yes.
But around my office, if I ran out of paper clips, I'd be in trouble.
Well, you know, they say that if they had socialism in the Sahara for sand, they'd start running out of sand. And I think that's maybe a little extreme, but socialism doesn't work. I don't know why it's so difficult to get this through people's heads, but Obama's very popular. He's very articulate. He's got charisma. And he's a socialist, and he's pushing socialism, and foolish people are going along with him.
In the last segment, you brought up the point, and we may not have time to complete this point, but we'll get started with it, about the American Medical Association being the strongest union in the United States and how it is really operating to keep costs up.
Yes, they restrict entry. They shift the supply curve to the left, as we economists say. There are two historical episodes that illustrate this very well. One is when Castro came into Cuba, a whole bunch of Cuban people came to this country. The upper classes came, and you'd get doctors and lawyers and physicists and mathematicians and chemists and archaeologists and people like that. And they all got jobs in the U.S. except for the doctors. The AMA tried to articulate it in such a way that it was very difficult for them to get jobs. And they made them you have to be a citizen, whereas a mathematician or a philosopher didn't have to be a citizen. And they made them take the medical exam in English, which ostensibly is supposed to promote quality, but they don't really need English. I mean, there are unconscious patients, and then there are other Spanish-speaking patients, and then there are translators. So they didn't really need to do English, but this was just an obvious way to preclude them from entry into the medical roles. And a similar thing happened in Vienna with the Jewish doctors, and we can talk about that a little bit after the break.
Okay, we're going to pick up this thread after the break. Folks, stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and with us is Megan O'Toole and Dr. Walter Block. We're talking health economics. We'll be right back. Stay with us. And welcome back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we have today Dr. Walter Block. And we're talking about health economics, and Dr. Block, you just were talking about how the AMA, actually restricts entry into medical schools. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. The number of applicants compared to the number of acceptances is the highest in any of the professional schools, higher than in law school, higher than in PhD schools. So the AMA restricts each medical school as to how many people they can take in. If you take in one more person than they say you can take in, you can lose your accreditation.
So what's the rejection rate approximately?
I don't have those figures, but the rejection rate is the highest of any of the advanced professional fields.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you just can't start up a medical school. I mean, suppose you and I, Michael, want to start be partners and we'll set up a medical school. Now, you and I are not doctors, so we'll have to hire doctors to be the professors and take care of patients, but it would be illegal. It would be impossible for us to do this. We would be not considered legitimate, and they wouldn't allow us to do it.
So let me jump in here and ask this question. So the AMA actually has to approve any new medical school to actually form, and then the government actually enforces the AMA's ruling on this.
Absolutely. The AMA is hand in glove with the government. It's one of these quasi-governmental institutions, sort of like the Fed. The Fed is ostensibly private like the AMA is, but in reality it's not, because the government will do exactly what the AMA says, just as the...
So this actually restricts the number of doctors that are actually able to even graduate and come into the workforce.
Right, and they also restrict foreign doctors, as I was mentioning with the Cuban and the Austrian doctors. So
you must be a U.S. citizen to actually get into a U.S. medical school?
I don't know that you have to be a U.S. citizen to get into medical school, but in order to, if you come from another country and you don't have a U.S. graduation,
mm-hmm.
then you had to prove that you were a U.S. citizen.
So the net result is that there is a restriction in the quantity of new doctors that can enter in, and this restriction on the number of doctors keeps prices up.
Precisely. Look, suppose we took a bomb and bombed half the orange crop. We just, you know, obliterated half the oranges. Would the price of oranges rise or not? Well, of course it would.
Sure.
Well, we're not bombing anyone here, happily, but we are preventing the oranges from being created in the first place, or the doctors from being created in the first place. So the remaining doctors, the doctors that are allowed to practice, earn a lot more money than they would, and somehow people think, well, this is part of capitalism. Nonsense. This is part of corporativism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, the basic principle that you brought out here that I like everyone to understand is that in economics, when you have a greater number consuming than producing, that keeps prices up.
Well,
very simple.
If demand rises, prices will rise. If demand falls, prices will fall.
Yeah.
If supply rises, prices will fall. And if supply falls, prices will rise. And here what they're doing is they're making supply fall, fewer doctors, and, of course, the prices rise, which makes it a problem because now it's so expensive and you need insurance, you need government help. In other words, what government does is first screws it up and then says, aha, there's a problem. It's all the fault of capitalism, which it's not. It's its own fault. And then it says, well, we have to fix it. And how are they going to fix it? Are they going to fix it by stopping their initial error? No. They're going to fix it by creating new errors. This is a point that Mises has made, that government intervention leads to more government intervention and leads to more government intervention. And only someone like Ron Paul or a libertarian or a different kind of limited government philosophy can see our way out of this crisis.
What about the objection that all these protections and restrictions are to keep the Jack the Ripper doctor and the incompetent doctor from getting through the system?
Well, that's the excuse, but as I said, with the Cuban doctors and the Jewish doctors from Vienna in the 30s who tried to get here to escape Hitler, they couldn't become doctors. And the fact that they took the exam in the English language, as I said, well, they're unconscious patients, and unconscious patients don't need communication, and then there are same language patients who you don't need a translator, and then there are translators. So it's got nothing to do with Jack the Ripper. Look, Milton Friedman, who's very good on this in his book Capitalism and Freedom, says the argument is we want only Cadillac doctors. We don't want Oldsmobile or Chevy or Honda doctors or Toyota doctors. Well, suppose we literally took that with cars. Suppose we said that we're going to ban all cars under the quality of Cadillacs. Well, Maseratis and Ferraris could still ride around, but that would be it. Would we as a consuming public of cars be better off with no Toyotas and no Chevys? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be walking or taking bicycles because those cars are very expensive.
Well, tell us the story about your cousin. I seem to recall that he's a very highly paid doctor that originally had a hard time getting into U.S. medical school.
Yes, my cousin Mike, originally applied to 25 medical schools, and they all rejected him. That was his first year. The second year, he applied to every medical school in the country, and they all rejected him. And then he went off to Europe and got his MD. He was in Italy and I think Belgium. And he came back with his MD. Now, he was a citizen, and he could speak English. He's from Brooklyn originally. And well, Brooklyn accent, but still English. And, you know, so he could pass the test, obviously, there's no question, but they still didn't want him to become a doctor because, you know, he didn't go to U.S. medical school, et cetera. So he had to sue and get a lawyer, and finally he snuck into the medical profession. And he's doing very, very well because there were so few doctors. He was able to jump over their hoops or jump over their hurdles, but not everyone is as keen and ambitious as he was.
Michael, can I just interject?
Sure.
I was on Medicaid for a time, for a brief period of time growing up, and I encountered quite a few, shall we say, GM, Chevy-level doctors and physicians. And I just think that that's evidence enough that we don't need more government health care because it does lower the quality as well.
Well, there's an old joke, you know, Megan, that, you know, if there's a, what do you call the person that graduates last in their class in medical school? You call them doctor.
Right.
And so, you know, the concept of, a quality health care just because of the ranking in a school, or just because of the number of people that are in a graduating class, doesn't really tell you about their quality, the quality of their of the healthcare that you're going to actually obtain from them.
Another phenomenon that hits on the quality is this medical malpractice thing, where doctors are told that they're not to testify against each other. And medical malpractice is another horrendous sort of a situation that also keeps prices up. Depending upon the specialty, a doctor can pay $100,000 or $200,000 a year just for medical malpractice insurance.
Right.
Now, in the free market, presumably people would be able to write contracts to their heart's content, and maybe one of the contracts I predict would be that you just make a contract with a doctor, and he does his best, and you can't sue him no matter what error he makes. And if he makes an error, it's too bad. But then he'll charge you a much lower price. Because if you demand, you know, perfection, which is denied us on this side of the Garden of Eden, doctors are human, they're not perfect, well, then, you know, then we have this crisis. So medical malpractice is another real problem. And the Republicans and even so-called free enterprises, like Richard Epstein, who's supposedly a libertarian, says, well, the cure for that is to cap malpractice awards. But that doesn't seem fair. I mean, it's very arbitrary to cap things. If somebody hurts you, you know, you should get whatever it's due, and artificial caps are not really compatible with free enterprise. A much better way to do it is to just allow doctors to write a contract that says, you can't sue me. Now, the courts may not uphold that. They'll say, well, it's not in the public good or something like that, but that just shows that we don't have free enterprise where people are able to make contracts between consenting adults.
What is the public good?
You know, at the core of this particular aspect of what we're talking about here is people would like to have a system where they could weed out mistakes before they happen. And, in other words, they're looking for some kind of an assurance process or something that's going to assure them that they don't have to worry about who they're going to go to see for medical care. What is the alternative to having government-sanctioned licensing?
Well, there is this thing called certification, and again, Milton Friedman is very good on that. The case that I often use to illustrate this point is the case of thalidomide, which is a very good morning sickness drug. Women in the first trimester are coughing their guts out, and thalidomide cured that, but it created birth defects, and the FDA is still in business, even though they approved of this this horrendous drug.
Right.
If there were a certification system instead of a monopoly system, people would not trust the FDA, and people wouldn't go to the FDA to be certified. And that's like a type 1 error where you approve of a bad thing, and now the FDA is busy doing type 2 errors, where they don't approve of potentially good things. For example, to get a new drug in costs millions of dollars in tens of years or decades, and there are people who are on their last legs dying of cancer, and the FDA won't allow them to try experimental drugs because they only allow a drug if it's proven beneficial, and they're still testing them. So the FDA is a horrible thing, And surely we would be better off if drug certification were done by a competing industry with many different firms rather than a monopoly. Well, it's the same with doctors. Why should we allow just one licensing board when we could have certification like, I don't know, kosher food is a certification. The rabbis certify that this food is kosher. Well, you don't have to believe them and you don't have to listen to them, but people do go to the rabbis and, you know, ask them to certify their foodstuffs because their imprimatur means something. Well, maybe we should have that. Not maybe. We definitely should have that sort of a system of competing certification for both drugs and doctors.
So do we have, can you give us some examples of other certifying agencies that among professionals that people are would readily recognize?
Well, previously, about 5 years ago, I would have given three answers. I would have said Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's for bonds and commercial paper. But they've been suborned by government, so they're not really a good example. Maybe a better example is testing laboratories, like for very fine machines. If one person is selling a machine to someone else, you get
it. Sure, like Underwriter Laboratories.
That's it. Underwriter Laboratories are a very good case in point. They're not governmental, and they have very good reputations, and there are competing firms in...
Because anybody who produces anything that's electrical, they basically send it to them, they test it, and if they don't get that UL seal of approval, then consumers know that that is probably suspect.
Right, precisely, and that works pretty well. We don't have crises there, or crises, and the reason is the market, the magic of the marketplace.
Because license actually works very different than certification. License basically denotes a blessing from some monopolistic authority, as opposed to a certification, which basically means that you can examine this and you can test it, but this is not a. There's no guarantee. There seems to be an implicit guarantee associated with this concept of license, at least in the mind of consumers.
Yes, certified public accountants, or CPA, is another good example. If you want to become a CPA, you have to pass their certification. But if you don't pass it or don't want to take the test, you can still be an accountant. You just can't call yourself a certified public accountant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we could have certified doctors, and then osteopath and chiropractic and all these other healing alternatives to mainstream medicine would be allowed. Whereas right now, I think they're going to get the short end of the stick. And I'm no expert in which medicine is best, but my claim as a free enterpriser is, you know, let people be free. And out of freedom, we get the best products and the best quality.
Mm-hmm. So let's go again back to this concept of what free enterprise is and is not. So free enterprise is not government mandates or restrictions. Free enterprise is really freely agreed to contracts.
Precisely. I mean, to the extent that government has any legitimate role, and this is a bone of contention among libertarians, some say they're the minarchists, they say we should have minimal government. Others are anarcho-capitalists, say that all so-called government actions and contributions can be done better by the private force. But taking the minimalist government perspective, the only legitimate function of a government is the armies to keep foreign bad guys off of us, police to keep local bad guys off of us, and courts to tell the difference. So you'd have laws against murder and theft and rape and fraud and things like that, and that would be pretty much it. Other than that, people would be free to choose, as Milton Friedman chose for the title of one of his books. And this would... Adam Smith wrote this book, The Wealth of Nations, and he asked why is it that there are certain nations that are very wealthy and others are not. And what he said pretty much is the nations that are wealthy are the ones that have economic freedom and private property rights and limited government. And the ones that are wallowing in difficulties are the ones where you have too much government.
Mm-hmm. So let's bridge to a different, slightly different related topic about body parts.
Oh, yeah.
I read recently that... every year there's about there's some 80,000 that are needed, and but there's only about 20,000 that are available for supply.
Yes. Well, you have two sources of kidneys, one from live people and one from dead people. whereas hearts and kidneys, hearts and livers and lungs can pretty much only come from dead people, because if you're alive, you need them for yourself, whereas we have extra kidneys. And this is another interference of the government in the health field. People are needlessly dying or are consigned to a life on kidney dialysis machines, which is not very pleasant, because they have this inveterate hate of commerce, and they think that, you know, body parts are inalienable and we shouldn't be allowed to sell them.
Well, so it's illegal for us to sell a kidney.
Right. It's illegal to sell a kidney. There was this basketball player, a very famous basketball player, Alonzo Mourning,
mm-hmm.
needed a kidney, and happily for him, I think his brother or his cousin donated one to him. But suppose not. I mean, he could have died or been confined to kidney dialysis machines and had a horrible life. He was lucky, but there are other people that are languishing for lack of these things, and the reason is because government will not allow markets, and if you allow markets, you allow incentives. People will, at a high enough price, we'll have 80,000 kidneys per year in the U.S., and no one will have to do without.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for those comments, Walter. We're going to come back right after the break for our last segment, folks. This is Radio Free Market. This is your host, Michael McKay, and please stay with us. We'll be right back in just a couple of minutes. Talk to you soon. Welcome back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we have our last segment here with Dr. Walter Block. And during the break, we were talking about this whole thing of immunizations, the swine flu, the coming winter season. And Megan, you were just making a point in our private conversation.
Yes. Basically, the swine flu, and people don't realize this, but the swine flu is actually not that much different from the regular flu. And it's gone through both Branson, where I was living in the past summer, and also through Pittsburgh, Kansas, on campus here. And people are able to recover from it, and the only people who die from it are the very young and the very old who are weak, have a weak immune system. And the only thing that is really a big concern, supposedly, is that there are no immunizations for it,
mm-hmm.
For all the different strains. And people are in a panic over something that is not necessarily any more life-threatening than the regular flu.
So obviously, at this point, people should make their own decision based on educating themselves.
Mm-hmm.
as to whether or not they feel that they're at risk or not.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about this from the vantage point of forced inoculations. You know, Walter, I'd like your comment on that. I feel very nervous when government starts to tell me that you have to be inoculated.
Yes, this is a great danger. On the other hand, you do have these extremist cases like Typhoid Mary. Now, she was an innocent person. She was not purposefully, she had no mens rea. She wasn't trying to hurt people. But she had typhoid, which is a deadly disease, and she was handling food and infecting people. And the question comes, under a libertarian society, would she be compelled to be quarantined? And if there was an inoculation, then either take the inoculation or stay in quarantine forever. And I think a case can be made very easily that Typhoid Mary, we should use violence against her if she doesn't want to cooperate, because she is, in effect, a murderer, even though she has no intent of doing that.
Mm-hmm. That phenomenon, I believe, is referred to as an uninvited border crossing. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. That certainly is. It's a violation of the non-aggression principle. I mean, she is aggressing against people by spewing forth germs or disease originators, and I think it's justified to use force to compel her to stop that, either an inoculation or quarantine or what have you. Now, but the burden of proof has to be on he who wants to use violence, and I don't see that burden of proof has been anywhere near met with this swine flu, which is much less of a deadly disease than typhoid. And it's not clear that the inoculation works. And, you know, there's just government run rampant in this case. But it's not a matter of principle. It's a matter
Well, you had mentioned in one of your writings that, and perhaps this was also from Murray Rothbard, that the law must be for normal people.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. Some people say that bad cases make bad law. I interpret Murray a little differently. I think that that's the Ayn Rand way of looking at it, and I think that libertarian code should apply to all sorts of weird cases, lifeboat situations, you know, people eating other people when they're lost in the woods or something like that. I think that libertarianism can stretch to even weird cases, or at least that's very interesting to try to apply it to the weird cases.
Well, you know, if we look at this situation about inoculations, you know, I think the critical thing is whether or not we should be subjected to forced inoculations at this particular time.
Yes,
and as a preventative measure.
And I think the burden of proof is on the government to prove that it has a case, and it certainly hasn't done so in the case of the swine flu.
Okay. Well, folks, we're going to wrap up the show. Walter, thank you very much for being with us. Megan also. And folks, please follow up and please check out the website Mises.org, Mises.org, for many of Walter's excellent articles and lectures there, as well as our website, RadioFreeMarket.com. And please listen to us next week. This is Michael McKay, and thank you very much for listening.